basically, the Judicial Department is supportive of these three bills because two of them particularly, Senate Bill 111 and Senate Bill 177, deal with problems that have arisen in diversion and the diversion program. And as many of you will recall, diversion was a program that was put together by the legislature to deal with two problems. One of them was the problem of first-time offenders who hadn't killed anybody or had no prior offenses of any other kind, allowing them to get treatment quickly and to sort of sidestep the judicial process without incredible expense to themselves, and yet to get it on their record so the next time they came down the pike, people would know that they'd been through this before. The second problem was basically a problem of courts, and that was that most first-time offenders who didn't have this way of stepping out of the system were requesting jury trials. And in certain areas of the state, these jury trials were backing up the courts because everybody wanted one, and there are an incredible number of DUII cases. So these two bills, the two bills, Senate Bill 111 and 177, the Judicial Department is supportive of. They came out of the Special Courts Committee appointed by the Judicial Department and by the Chief Justice, and they address some problems with the diversion program. I would like to point out a couple of points on Senate Bill 111 specifically. You will be seeing, no doubt, a fiscal impact statement from the State Court Administrator's office, and it'll go through the fiscal office downstairs, that will come to the neighborhood of $272,000 a biennium on Senate Bill 111. I wanted to explain the basis for this fiscal impact statement so that you'll understand it. On page 6 of the bill, lines 2 and 3, you'll find that the new language would allow the court to reinstate a diversion agreement at any time before conviction, acquittal, or dismissal with prejudice on defendant's motion. Our feeling is that that would become, and the reason for the impact, is that that motion would become a standard motion in every trial, would probably extend each trial by 15 or 20 minutes. When you're talking of the number of DUIs that you're talking in Oregon, which is in the neighborhood of 20,000 or more biennium, 15 minutes to each trial adds time. That's not something that we ask money for. It's what we consider to be incremental costs, and those are costs that we try and swallow, basically, as the Judicial Department, by operating more efficiently and bring up to the Ways and Means Committee as a whole. I know that you have a letter from Judge Leapy that addresses concerns with this particular section. I think Judge Leapy's amendments would reduce the costs substantially that we targeted in relation to this particular section. There was one other minor point that I, technical
Senator
point.
Senator Cohen.
Assuming those amendments went forward, what sort of, would it change the intent of the bill to the extent to which it would not quite measure up to its intentions?
I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I wonder, Senator Cohen, if we shouldn't get direction from somebody as to whether this should go to Ways and Means before we send it to the floor.
No, of course not. I didn't. I never asked to have that happen today.
No, I know you didn't, but I know you're interested in that. Just wonder if this was the time not to get an expression of this committee's viewpoint, whether these bills with fiscal impact should go somewhere else first before they come here for policy decisions.
One other technical.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wires.
I don't think they ought to go anywhere else, but I sure hope we'll look at what it does to the court doc. With the experience I mentioned to the judge before some people got here, I've changed my view a little bit since my zeal of passing the diversion, being involved in passing the diversion bill. And when I initially heard that some defense lawyers or defendants were throwing their diversion over in the pile, hoping that it would kind of slide through even though they had a prior or something like that, and that made me mad when I heard about it right after we passed that. I've gone almost full circle after seeing the cost to the system of the district attorney routinely objecting and and requiring a hearing when they find some fairly, I always hate to use the word minor in these circumstances, but some technical problem because of the precious cost. And if a person goes to diversion, they get into alcohol treatment. If they go to trial, they usually lose, and then they go to alcohol treatment. It seems to me that we ought to get them into alcohol treatment as soon as we can, because frequently, most people who get drunk driving tickets are able to maintain, but there are some of the people who get drunken driving tickets who are just absolutely disintegrating, and they're people who have multiple drunken driving tickets and get involved in vehicular homicide and a lot of other things. And if you've got one of those people hung up waiting around for a hearing because there's some technical difficulty with getting into it, I just think we ought to try to resolve all conflicts in favor of getting people into diversion.
I'm not objecting to that. I just want to make sure that the amendments of what we're doing here.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just speaking to Senator Frey's point about fiscal impact.
Of course, it's occurred to me that when I'm wondering what the justification is for even having, maybe I should ask this of one of the judges, but the judges ought to be able to tell by themselves whether a person should go into diversion. Why do we have this requirement that the district attorney's got 15 days to object anyway? Anybody know that? I should have asked the judge if that was really necessary in order to protect the integrity of the system, but I've neglected to do that.
They don't go before the judge if they go into diversion.
Mr. Chairman, the district...
Counsel, go ahead. The
district attorney uses that time to do a record check either in-state or out-of-state to determine if there's been a prior diversion program or prior DUI conviction or a prior disqualifying motor vehicle conviction. Sometimes the judges don't have, or often the judges don't have that information available at the time of arraignment.
I just remembered my horror story, which I think I can give briefly, if I can.
All right, Senator Wires.
I had a client who was in his early 60s who was starting to have some problems with his thinking processes. Question maybe could be brought up, should the guy continue to drive? But that wasn't in front of the whole situation. And he couldn't remember for sure whether he'd had a prior DUI within 10 years. And I was not going to go and tell him, just go ahead, you're not sure. It's not in Oregon. I checked, it wasn't in Oregon. And I wasn't going to encourage a client to perjure themselves. So I said, well, we'll check in Washington. By the time we got the word back from Washington that he hadn't had a DUI in Washington, the 30 days had run. Could we then get a hold of the district attorney in Multnomah County and explain that to them by letter and trying to call them and get in touch with them and say, for goodness sakes, let him go into diversion. He's not stalling. No, 30 days have gone by. We sat all morning. It happened that a judge or two were sick that day, and they crammed them all together into one courtroom. And I sat there and watched one person after another. And as my temper was rising, knowing my overhead was running, I thought, no, it's good for you. You're a state senator. Sit here and watch. And one after another comes up in front of the judge. 30 days had run because of this reason or that reason. Some of them really didn't belong in diversion, but a number of them did. And I thought to myself right there, if I get a chance to get back down here next session, I'm going to try and undercut the ability of the district attorney to be a technocrat, because I wrote a letter and I tried to make a phone call, which wasn't returned because they're a bureaucratic organization. They run all the files around, and the person who's actually going to appear that day doesn't even have the file when you're trying to call them in advance. So I'm sorry.
All right.
But I really like to encourage counsel to help us find a way without destroying the diversion program, cut back on technical objections by the state that's costing the state money and keeping people who should be in the alcohol treatment program out of it longer. Because we had to wait till we had that hearing, which we won, to then go to a judge and go into the diversion program so then he could get into alcohol treatment.
Well, this might be the bill to change some of those things.
Might want to think about that.
Any other questions? Were you through? You weren't through yet.
Yeah, I have.
Go ahead.
One more thing, a technical point to raise on page 2, line 24. In the new section 3, it says a defendant is eligible for diversion if, and then it lists the criteria for eligibility. As a practical matter, even though much of this is what's taken out of current law, as a practical matter, by stating if a defendant is eligible for diversion if, and then listing them, to some people, that will probably make it seem like all you have to do is meet those criteria and you get diversion automatically. In truth, if you go over to page 4, ORS 813-220, you'll find that in addition to being eligible, you have to be approved by the judge. You might want to make some kind of amendment to page 2, line 24, so that people who read that section out of context understand that in addition to being eligible, you have to be approved by a judge. It may stop some phone calls to counsel, your counsel during the interim, asking what you meant. Other than that, the Judicial Department is generally supportive of efforts by judges and by other people to make the diversion programs work as well as the legislature originally intended them to. We feel that, by and large, they've been doing a good job.
Questions? All right, thank you. Let's see, anyone else out there that didn't get signed up for Senate Bill 111? All right, we'll close the public hearing. Senate Bill 111. We'll move to Senate Bill 177. Oh, wait a minute. Come on back up. As long as you're here, you might as well. Can you take on 177 now? As long as you're sitting up there.
I think I've signed up for all four bills that you've got up, if you just want me to.
Well, okay. Well, all right.
Okay, 177, basically, we're in support of 177 and don't have any problems with the bill. It appears fine to us.
Okay. Well, I suppose, who we got, Judge Harris again? This is the principal speaker for it. All right. All right, I may call you back. Maybe I should have waited and call up some other folks to kind of explain things first. Judge Harris, come back if you would, please.
Senator Frye. The Special Courts Committee again proposed the format for Senate Bill 177. The purpose of that was to avoid the problem that arose in Multnomah County, where a defendant chose to go to trial, was convicted by a jury, and before he was sentenced, therefore not convicted, he applied for diversion. A Multnomah County judge denied that, saying, you don't qualify for diversion, you've had your trial. That was appealed. The Court of Appeals reversed, saying that's not one of the bases for denying diversion. Went back to the judge. He then used one of the other criteria for denial, that being he didn't have an early recognition of the problem, didn't apply within 30 days, or some other the other reasons. This bill is to suggest that if a person chooses to go to trial, they may not thereafter apply for diversion to avoid that kind of problem.
All right. Well, what is the okay? I realize this would take care of that result, but I still don't understand what the problem is. What you mean? The problem is, of course, of going through a trial, I suppose, and that's taking time and costs. That's the
right. The purpose would be to avoid people choosing to go to trial, and then since there is a time even after a judgment saying that they are guilty, they are not convicted of that offense until sentencing, and they technically could, even in mid-trial, say they wish to apply for diversion. This would prevent them from taking that option. And we don't feel it's appropriate that if people choose to go to trial and exercise that right, that they thereafter attempt to get into the diversion program.
All right. Any questions to Judge Harris? All right, thank you.
Judge Harris, do you know whether there are any numbers in terms of how often this is happening?
I can't tell you. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I know that it happened in the city of Lake Oswego in a local city court, lots of problems with that kind of thing.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Uli's here.
Good afternoon. My name is William Uli. I'm an attorney in Portland, and my practice is limited to privately retained driving under the influence and drug defense. I just heard Judge Harris talk about the case in the Court of Appeals where they allowed, I believe it would be called post-trial diversion, and that was my case.
Well, you won in the Court of Appeals. See what you can do with this committee.
Well, Judge McGilligan gets back there. I mean, I can tell you, the law says you can do it, and but it's like pulling teeth to get judges to follow the law. It's being applied as a docket clearing technique, this diversion. I really don't know what to say. I talked to Mr. Kramer, I think on Friday. He asked me what I felt about the constitutionality of Senate Bill, 177. And in the Ewan brief, that's the case that Judge Harris was talking about, there was a portion of that dealt with my interpretation of the constitutionality of that provision, the diversion statute, as it's currently written. And I think that there's a real constitutional problem with it as it's written. If you go ahead with Senate Bill 177, I feel that the problem would be there'd be more of a problem constitutionally. And I think the reason for that is, if you'll bear with me just for a second, it's not real complicated, but what this diversion statute does is it chills a defendant who's charged with crimes right to assert his constitutional rights to trial, to counsel, and to cross-examine the police officer. And if you do that, then I have real doubts if the legislature or the courts are putting a price on the exercise of constitutional rights, whether those rights really are worth anything. And if they're not worth anything, then the bill would be, in my opinion, unconstitutional.
Okay, I wonder if I could, let me see if I'm tracking with you on this thing now. And I don't get involved in these cases myself, but what I think what you're saying is that a defendant comes into court charged with driving under the influence, and it's kind of like an aggravated murder case where he might plead guilty in order to avoid the death penalty. And what you seem to be saying is that a person gives up a right to trial and thereby avoids a conviction, but maybe there are people who are seeking diversion who really ought to be tried, because maybe really there is a question about their guilt. And so you're never going to get that. Sometimes you won't get that close question resolved because the person's going to opt out for diversion because that's a sure way to go, whereas in order to avoid the risk of being convicted, why, you avoid a trial when maybe there is good reason to go to trial. Maybe the state doesn't have a very good case.
Senator, most of the people that come through my office that are eligible for diversion are scared to death of the penalties when I tell them about the one-year license suspension and the 2 days in jail or 80 hours of community service. The other two are the same, alcohol treatment, and the money is about the same whether you're tried or not. And whether they're innocent or not, or feel they're innocent, they say, I can't afford to lose my license. I can't take a chance on that. And I can tell you that there is a real chilling effect because of this bill. Now, and you can take it, if you want to clear the dockets and stop people from trying these drunk driving cases, I thought about this on the way down as an argument in support of why I think this is unconstitutional. What you could do is make the penalty, and this is in the province of the legislature, you can make the penalty anything you want for any offense. And for drunk driving, why don't you make it a capital offense?
That's been suggested before, you know.
Sure, and make it death by hanging. Make it worse than just legal
injection.
Summary execution
by the police officer has been suggested.
But when you make it a capital offense, tell the person that if you go the diversion route, then you don't have to worry about this. Or if you're not eligible for diversion, if you plead guilty, then we'll make it just a misdemeanor one-year sentence, and you can go ahead with that penalty, and we'll the legislature prescribe a schedule of penalties, first conviction a week, second conviction a month in jail, third conviction 3 months, and then we'll just do it that way. And I think you'd have very few people actually contesting what the police officer is saying about them, because if they lost, you gave them their right. You said, this is a criminal charge. We're going to provide you with a right to counsel. You can have a trial, and you can cross-examine this cop. But if you do, and if you lose, you've had it. And, you know, you'd solve the problem completely. And if you don't think it's constitutional as it's written now, the analogy is exactly the same. You're putting a price tag on it. I guess just one other thing I was going to say is I think probably the real impetus behind this is docket clearing and not having juries decide guilt or innocence. But, you know, those juries are the same people that come right off the you know, to be a juror, you have to be a voter. And, if you don't trust their judgment, you know, I figure you people would be the ones least apt to question their judgment instead of sending these cases to the police to be tried and saying, if the police arrest you, then we're going to really penalize you and you don't get a jury trial.
Burns? He's a little behind the times on that question.
Beg your pardon?
About us people here having confidence in juries to decide questions. It's become a rebuttable presumption.
Well, you know, I thought about that on the way down, too. I thought, you know, if we took jurors out of the phone book, I think, from my standpoint, the defense would be better off. But we take them out of the voting rolls, and those are, you know, the exact same people that vote every time. And, you know, you figure if you trusted their judgment with yourselves, why not with whether somebody's guilty or innocent?
We wouldn't want these non-lawyers on this committee to think that juries are charged with the responsibility of determining a person's guilt or innocence when we know very well as lawyers that there's only one question for the jury: has the state proved the guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? And the question of innocence is never decided by a jury in a criminal case.
No, that's correct. Is there any questions about this? I took a portion of the brief I wrote in Ewan regarding the constitutionality of diversion as it is. I haven't really thought about it too much because of the short notice, but I did on the way down, and so...
Yes, based upon the opinion in the case that you argued, you think that there is an absolute right on the part of a defendant after a trial to ask for diversion. Is that clear now in your view?
There's a right to ask for it. There's not a right to it. The judge, there's those four criteria, and that's where the judges are using their discretion to not do it.
I mean, it's clear enough now that a defendant is not precluded from asking for diversion because he's been through a trial.
Right. And what I'm doing now on some of these people that are divertible, there's all this, vernacular that goes with this now. Divertible, that means they're eligible for diversion but elect to go to trial. And what I've done with these people is, and I haven't really had one come up yet to trial where I've lost and had them go, but have them evaluated within that 30-day period privately, and then have them enter their own program privately, and then try the case. And if I lose, then opt for the diversion. And, you know, I don't know how a judge is going to turn that down, but I have faith that these judges will find a way to do it. So maybe the best bet for you to do is to enact this bill so you take the pressure off of them. But I do think it's unconstitutional.
Questions by anybody?
Anybody else?
Thanks. All right, Judge McCormick, rebuttal time.
I guess before I get started, there's an amendment that the governor's task force wanted to put on this matter on line 13, which says, notwithstanding paragraph A of the subsection, they may not file after entry of a guilty plea or after commencement of a trial. We suggested that we add, or no contest plea, so that there's no question that we're talking about a plea of any kind. So it's not just a guilty plea, but a no contest plea as well. And so I'd like to suggest that as far as the diversion statute being unconstitutional, I respectfully disagree with counsel. I guess the point that he was saying is that they have a right to file for it after trial, but they don't have a right to have it granted. That's the whole point. Diversion is not a right. Diversion is a privilege. That's the statute and the history, as far as I can see, make it very clear that that's the case. There are certain criteria that are set out for someone to be eligible for diversion, but there's a certain amount of discretion in the court that's given to the court whether or not it's likely that a person would finish the program. There is no question in my mind that diversion is a privilege. There's no question in my mind that the Court of Appeals of the Supreme Court of this state would so state in so many words. The diversion, after all, was set up for the early recognition of an alcohol problem. I have no doubt that it was set up to help the court docket along and early treatment if there was an alcohol problem. If you allow people to request a trial, have a trial 6 months later in some jurisdictions, 30 or 40 days in my jurisdiction, but 6 months later in some jurisdiction, they have a trial at some point, then they're found guilty by a jury, which the state pays for. A lot of times the state pays for that attorney that that represents the defendant. They always pay for the judge and the court staff that is there. Then we let him file for a diversion. I think the system as it's set up, another reason why I believe the system is constitutional is that after all, when a defendant comes into court, the court tells him, look, you have a right to file for this diversion, and if you want to talk with an attorney about it, you can. He has the right to court-appointed counsel at state expense to explain to him, this is what you're looking at, this is the chances you're going to be found guilty, in my opinion, this is what the possible penalties are, pro and con, and the guy makes an informed decision. Now, as a practical matter, we're not finding that, because I agree with counsel, I think the driver's license is a major stick. But as a practical matter, I think the defendants have plenty of rights. It is a privilege. It's not a right. I think the statute is constitutional. This Senate Bill 177 will make the statute more workable and less expensive rather than unconstitutional, in my humble opinion. I'd be happy to answer any questions you'd have.
I don't understand why lawyers always have to disagree on must be more on one side to these things. You sometimes wonder whether there are two sides to some of these questions we run into around here, but there still are. Okay. I mean, thanks a lot, then.
Thank you.
Okay, Judge, let's see. Let's see now. Let's see. Who all have I got here on this one? All right, let's have Ed Jones back again, please.
I'm Ed Jones, Multnomah Defenders. I'm also here for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This provision, the current state of the law, which simply allows a judge to consider whether a particular defendant, even after losing a trial, may go into diversion, strikes me as a rather harmless situation. I frankly don't think we need to fix it. The experience we've gone through is that the judges consider them and then they reject them. They don't give you. Now, it may be that Bill Yulee will finally devise a situation where the judge will give him one of these, but we're not talking about very many cases. All that the current law does is preserve some discretion so that a judge could, in an appropriate case, divert someone even after they lost a trial. And I don't see that there is any need to simply foreclose that possibility. It's just not that big an issue. There may well be those cases where it is appropriate for a judge to divert somebody after trial, and I think that possibility should be left open.
All right, questions? Thank you. Mark McDonald.
Mark McDonald from the Marion County District Attorney's Office for the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I think Senate Bill 177 is a good bill. I think it will remove the potential problems for people abusing the diversion system. I think it would make it equitable to all defendants throughout the state of Oregon and not to have them be treated differently in different jurisdictions. If you happen to have a judge in some municipality or some county that would routinely allow people who go to trial to get on the diversion program, it doesn't seem fair that they should be treated differently than the rest of the people charged with DUII in the rest of the state. A couple of changes I think should be made though is on page 1, line 13, I would suggest that you include no contest pleas. Make sure that there's no confusion as to what sort of pleas, whether or not somebody would be eligible for diversion. And then on page 2, line 20, the section 2, it currently reads that it become applicable upon the date upon that appears on the summons. I think that should probably be changed to the date of the offense. Because there could be some differences there. I believe Senate Bill 177 is constitutional. I would make an analogy to DUI, to district attorney diversions. In those diversions, the state can actually require the defendant to plead guilty or no contest before the diversion is entered into. And those have been upheld, and I don't see any distinction between those and this type of diversion.
Questions? All right. Brad Swank, do you have anything on this? You're signed up now. Do you want to come back and say anything more on it? Or might as well.
Brad Swank for the State Court Administrator's Office. One of the arguments that, again, we are in support of this concept because we feel it makes diversion work better and more in the way the legislature originally intended it when it passed the bill. One issue to think about is the issue of cost. And
board and everyone ought to be treated the same. That's exactly what this bill does. It's a good piece of legislation, in my opinion. I won't take up any more of your time unless you have any questions.
All right. Okay, thanks, Judge. Mark McDonald, you want anything to say? All right. Judge McElliott, are you still here?
Just left.
Well, that's all I've got signed up. No, I got Brad Swank signed up.
Briefly, the issue for the state court administrator's time is something that's been mentioned. It's a matter of court time, and we find that attorneys try to delay to get beyond the end of the period. This is a bill that was passed last session by this committee, as a matter of fact, went to the House where it died. The State Court Administrator's Office was supportive of it when you came up with the idea. We were supportive of it when the Special Courts Committee comes up with the idea. I haven't seen the amendments, but your counsel explained the concept to me, and we're supportive of his amendments. We think that it improves the law, basically. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 178, and that takes care of all 1, 2, 3, 4 bills that we've had on the agenda for public hearings today. We will go to a work session, and we will turn to, yes, we'll take just a minute here. We are going to turn to our red books.
I certainly want to wait for Eric. Well, no, I don't. I think he's got whatever he's got together.
Stand at ease for a moment. Till our counsel returns or gets here.
I only have one cigarette. Okay, let's go.
Thank you.
Okay, the... We'll be back in session now, and let's see. Should I move to table this bill now, Senator Wires, or...
I think we've got it all pretty well compromised, don't we? I was reading the paper today. Pretty well worked out. I've gone around and told a lot of people that I thought there was a compromise about to be put together.
Well, all right. Council, do you want to start? Tell us what direction to head.
Well, are we going to do torts or insurance to start with?
We're going to do Senator Cohn's work here for a bit.
Okay.
Hopefully we can finish that part of this anyway. We'll give it a shot.
Okay, collateral benefits we can put aside
for a moment.
You have
three things that have been put in front of you. Two of them are memos. One is on collateral benefits from Karsten Rasmussen, and one is on collateral benefits from me. And since we're not going to deal with collateral benefits for a while, you can set them aside. The main utility is on page one of Karsten's memo, which lists the things that are considered to be collateral benefits by the courts. So, for example, if you're talking collateral benefits, it includes pension benefits, life insurance benefits, and so on, which are things that are not subrogated. The other thing that you have in front of you is a set of pages labeled 123 revised through 130 revised, assuming that they came out of the copier. Those go in your red book in place of the current pages 123 through 30. They deal with the liability of directors of for-profit corporations, and we'll talk about those when we get there. Yeah.
123? 123. Down at the bottom. No, we put that in.
Look down at the bottom of the, yeah.
Where do we put it?
In place of the current pages 123.
Oh, yeah. 123.
Which may be in the front of your book and may be in the...
Well, it's right here in mine.
Yes.
128.
128. You have 129. No reason. You can't.
130.
Wait till you get involved in the back of stuff here. I'm going to sit down and just giggle. Giggle.
There.
So take this
giggle.
Out.
That's right. Yeah.
We're going to take 123 through what out?
Through 130 out and put in 123 revised through 130 revised.
Oh, okay. On the floor.
I guess ready. The
my book is now, Mr. Carlson, it goes from page 128 to one that isn't numbered to page 131.
Okay, the numbers may have been left off the bottom when it was copied.
But should I change the 131 that's in my book?
No.
Leave that in there.
Yes. Okay. For the senators who just came in, you have three things in front of you. Two are memos dealing with collateral benefits, which is section 13.
Well, I don't know if we need to go back over all that. They can read the minutes if they want
to
find out what happened.
Okay. We are...
My motion to table failed by one vote, so that's why we're continuing with this agenda.
Starting with the sections of the bill that Senator Cohen is handling, which are the insurance sections, which you will find in your either in a bill or red notebook, whatever you're working out of. And up first is section 59. If you look on page 3.
Is that under, on page 3?
Page 3, handwritten 3 in your red. Book.
It's under insurance amendments in the back.
Amendments.
It's the back half. The back half of the red book, folks. After the yellow.
Here we go.
The issue is whether you want to adopt section 59, either as written in the bill, which is on page 2, actually. You can see how it sits in page 2, or as it is on page 3 with the clarification amendments that I've proposed. Now, Senator Cohen, I assume that you want to handle this section by section.
Well, I've also forgotten, you know, I've gone through this once, and I figured I'd leave it up to the chairman the second time around since I briefed everybody once. I guess I'd recommend that we adopt... What we're doing here is taking out the petition by deleting section 60 and 61 and 62 from the bill. We have eliminated a person petitioning for review of cancellation, requesting a jury trial, etc. And we've discussed it before. My recommendation is that we leave 59 in. That is, it's my understanding, a codification, correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, of a rule that the current insurance,
that's intact currently. If you look on page 1, the current rule is OAR 836-85-03, and you can see a summary of the current administrative rule there.
Anyway, so I guess I would move. The only question I had here in our discussions was whether there was a hearing time with a question mark. We wondered whether Chapter 180, you know, the 183 was sufficient, and I guess what we've come back to, if we adopt Section 59, as you see in front of you on page handwritten 3, we are relying on the 731.240 for their general hearing times and specifications. Isn't that right, Eric?
That's correct.
On the general insurance code. So I guess I would move that we... That we go ahead and take care of Section 59 by adopting Eric's technical amendments, which conform it to current practice in their rule.
Okay. What my amendments do, Section 59 is currently written in what I consider to be a negative form. It says no insurance company may, and I've changed it so that an insurance company shall not. And then the rest of the changes are either clarifications or make sure that the authority granted to the commissioner is explicit. So I've tried not to make any policy changes in there.
Okay, any objection? All right, so we're up next. Yes. Senator Brennan.
Mr. Chairman, I've looked at some language that someone suggested to me that I'd like to propose here that we discuss for just a minute as an alternative to that section 59, but to do the same thing as Senator Cohen suggested. This section 59 would say no insurer authorized to write and who is writing commercial liability insurance in this state may terminate any class or line of commercial liability insurance without notifying the insurance commissioner of their intent and their reasons for such action at least 90 days prior to the termination of the line or class. The notice shall include all data relied upon by the insurer making the decision. It is pretty...
What's the difference?
Pardon?
What's the change?
Well, I think your motion included this information on page 3, right?
That's it.
I just thought it did do it in a little more succinct manner, maybe.
All right. Well,
think it does the same.
Discussion on this?
Well, I can't relate to something I don't have in front of me. The other thing is I can't relate to anything. And what we did here was to use their administrative rule and to not throw anybody in a fuss again because that's where we started from, and the attempt was to codify existing rule that has been officially adopted and in place. So...
Are you,
Mr. Chair, was there a timeline, Joyce, in yours?
We discussed the timeline last time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what we have here is we are the insurance code specifies under 731.240 the request for hearing. Mm-hmm. Anyone aggrieved can have a hearing. There is no timeline built into that. You know, and I have a question mark, hearing time with a question mark on our discussions here about this. I don't know whether there's a material change in, number one, the intention of Senator Brenneman's substitute. I don't know whether there's an intended change or what it does differently, and I guess I'd ask him to tell me what it does differently.
Puts it into a 90-day frame where they have to make notice of their intent or reasons for such action at least 90 days prior to termination.
And I think it puts the onus more on the insurance commissioner regarding the data that he's expected to have prior to making the decision. So rather than statutorily identifying the kinds of data.
Well, I guess, I would recommend we set it aside then, and either if you want to make, I'm certainly not willing to deal with anything unless I see it in paper and hear a response from the insurance commissioner's office.
Where we are is the following.
We can either, we either move it now.
Their motion, to which I ask if there's any objection. Apparently, I treat this alternative language as an objection. So right now, the motion before us is Senator Cohn's motion to adopt the language on page 3, and we'll just call a roll and go on unless
without a time specific.
We're open for amendments.
Well, it sounds as though the Brenneman idea accomplishes about the same thing, but with putting a specific time in, which I'd like to.
Well, I think it's I agree with Senator Cohen. It's a little difficult for us to consider something we don't have in front of us. Is the only thing.
I mean, I'm happy to put a timeline. It's on 59 as drafted here, sort of a hearing time within a certain time. I think, mm-hmm. But I'm not prepared to kind of rearrange all the words again and start all over.
Do we have any suggestions?
Senator Hill has a.
Timeline, Senator Hill.
Mr. Chairman, just a procedural thing. I mean, staff has gone through the trouble of putting yet another notebook together for us, and it's just like anything else. If we could get these amendments ahead of time, we could consider them. But again, it's just without having them in front of us to look at, it's hard to proceed.
Well, that's
what
true.
Is the standard hearing time? Do we have anyone from the insurance commissioner's office here today?
Well, generally, it's I think
they
it's
are in meetings with CNA Insurance and are available if we want them I can have
Yeah, I think it's reasonable. I'd like to come back. You know, I'd like to adopt this and flag it for coming back to put a time certain for a hearing, you know, for a request for hearing. Certainly, there ought to be a reasonable time in which they can schedule a hearing, and I can't imagine. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. I do want to make sure that whatever time either fits what's within the code buried someplace. I don't know enough about the code or whether they finally revert back to the Chapter 183 and see if Chapter 183 applies, then we do have a hearing time after request in the Administrative Procedures Act. And I guess that's where we need somebody to clarify this whole thing. Once again, we've been over it once.
I thought we talked about it.
Well, can we adopt this? Can we adopt this thing in concept and go back later in terms of this timeline?
Mr. Chairman, I'd adopt it as it is, and then we can further amendment. We can further amend it if we need to put a hearing date in.
Is there any objection to that? All right, that's the word. Let's go on to the next one. Which would be
go ahead.
If we want to take formal action on 60 through 62.
Yes. I move deletion of 60, 61, and 62.
Mm-hmm. You want to under discussion on that, Senator Cohen? We discussed that enough already, you think?
I hope so.
All right. Any objection to doing that? All right. That's the word.
Okay, let's go to page 5 and 6, which deals with cancellation of policies. Section 63 through 71, for those of you who are following along in your scores.
We discussed that, and we struck the language on line 15 on page 6, didn't we? That sentence beginning on line 15.
Right.
We have struck the sentence beginning on line 15. That's correct. There are a couple of things you need to look at. Again, the handwritten changes are things that I have done for what seem to me to be clarity. If they don't seem that way to you, just X them out. What you need to do is look at section 68 sub 3 on lines 8 through 10 of page 6 in your red book. Combine that with lines 43 and 44 on line 5. The problem with the current language is that beginning sentence to section 68 says, an insurer which cancels or intends not to renew a liability policy must comply with the following requirements. And then sub 3 says that a post office certificate of mailing shall constitute conclusive proof. Now, that's not really a must comply kind of a sentence, and you have two alternatives. One is to leave subsection 3 in there as it is, but to make it a standalone section so that it simply says if they send a certificate of mailing, that's conclusive proof. And the other thing is to simply delete subsection 3 so that then there is no standard of conclusive
proof.
Why
would we want to do any of it? I don't understand what you're
Well,
construction problem.
It's a construction it's problem. It's one of these things that hit Joan Robinson and me after our last discussion. This bill is full of these kind of problems that seem to be popping up. The more we discuss, the more we find. The problem is that the language of subsection 3 of section 68 does not fit the introductory sentence. And we talked some earlier about the issue of subsection 3 because of the cost to the insureds. And you may want to take action on that basis now. All I'm trying to do is raise the technical issue of how you have it in here.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
I really want to leave it in there. I think there's no reason why the insurance companies ought not to at least mail, first-class mail notice rather than a bulk notice. I'm really firm about that. And I don't care what we have to do to the other sentence. I'd like to firm it up some more if the committee, if the, I'll require them to send a $2
register,
whatever it is, if that's
from a technical
what we
point
have to do.
If I understand the post office correctly, from a technical point of view, a certificate of mailing is something that you buy in addition to a first-class stamp, and it costs somewhere around 75 cents. And then there is a postcard that goes on the letter so that when it's delivered, the post office fills that out and sends it back, and then you also get a thing that you get to put in your file that says, hey, I mailed this. Pardon?
And they signed it.
Well, if they sign it, it's a return receipt requested, which is an additional step which costs you an additional two bits or 50 cents or something like that. Yeah, yeah. But what this provides is a certificate of mailing. Yeah, a post office certificate of mailing.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Wires, yeah. Wouldn't it solve the problem to ask Eric to construct this section so it conforms to English usage and legislative drafting, or is that leaving too much discretion to him? He says that one way to do it would be to have it stand alone. I guess if we're going to do that, then we'd have a subsection 1, and then we'd have A and B, and then we'd have a subsection 2, and what is now subsection 3 would become subsection 2.
Look, I think we ought to leave it in, and I think we ought to, for goodness sakes, rearrange it properly in the way of drafting. I mean, I can't believe you can't make that, and I would hope
it can work. Yes. Yeah. The policy issue is whether you want to leave that kind of notice in, and if you do, I'll make it work. The other...
I support Senator Cohen wanting to leave it in.
The other issue that we were going to take a look at was the issue of... I'm sorry.
Are we settled with this one? Well, can we get
is there any objection to just leaving it in now? All right, go ahead.
No delete. The other issues involve time periods. On your handwritten page 6, lines 1 through 3 deal with the time period for a cancellation notice. Currently says 10 days. The OAR used by the commissioner is 10 days. The statute for cancellation of automobile liability insurance policies is 20 days, except for non-payment of premium, which is 10 days. In subsection 2, lines 4 through 7, the time period there is 30 days. The current rule is also 30 days. I hope I'm remembering correctly. No, it's 20 days, so you're giving people 10 more days than the current rule. And the current statute on automobile liability non-renewal, which is the only comparable thing I had to look at, was also 20 days. So by specifying 30 days for non-renewal, you're giving people 10 days more than they're given now under such rules as are in existence to look for another source of insurance.
Mr. Chairman, we're talking about line 11. Is that it? 40, which is currently written at 45.
Then when we go to line... I'm talking up on lines 1 and 4. There are time periods there, and then there's also a time period...
We're not talking about that one yet.
Okay.
We're talking about 30 days.
There's also the time period in line 11, which was 45 days. People expressed dissatisfaction with it last Thursday, but nobody had a substitute to put in. So those three time periods simply need to be resolved.
Can we go through them one at a time?
Certainly.
The top one, which is now currently written 10.
Right.
The cancellation, it gives you, you've got 10 days after you receive a written notice of cancellation.
To find other insurance. That's the guts of that section.
And that essentially is the current rule and?
Yes, that's the current rule. The current statute on auto liability cancellation is 20 days, except for non-payment of premium, which is 10 days.
What if there's a conflict between the 10 days after the insured receives the notice and the date that's stated in the notice as to the effective date? The notice itself says this shall be effective on a certain date, and what if that is maybe less than 10 days after the insured gets notice?
I think that's the point of what is now subsection 3 at lines 8 through 10, which says that the post office certificate of mailing shall constitute conclusive proof that the insured received notice 3 calendar days after the date of the certificate of mailing, so that presumably the insurance company would know to put the date 13 days out from the date they mailed it, so that's 3 days for it to get there and 10 days for it to be effective after the presumed date of receipt.
That's clear, Eric, in the language.
I believe it is, yes. I mean, there are other statutes mm-hmm. scattered through the ORS that do similar kinds of things.
I don't have any, well, I guess I don't have any, I'm okay with 10 unless somebody wants to change it, but just a flat 10. I mean, that's their current rule. If somebody wants to extend it, I'd go long. I don't know.
Outside of auto.
Right. Well, aren't any...
I think you're probably... Okay. Remember, we're talking about a limited number here. We're not...
Yeah, I was talking about auto liability policies just as an analog because they are specifically accepted from the operation of these sections by Section 70. But it was just some place to go to look to see what other kinds of notice were provided to people for...
What important about
insurance.
The next
okay.
section on 30 days for non-renewal?
The next, yes.
So are we okay with 10, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I think that's the consensus.
Okay, I'm going to mark an okay then.
Anybody have any comments on this 30-day?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I guess.
Senator Hill?
Mr. Chairman, I guess we're talking, the council